Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. I am truly honored and excited to introduce my guest today, Mike Lewis, who started a program called Growing Warriors, where he teaches our ever-important veterans how to grow food sustainably. And he's going to share with us a little bit about his hemp project, too, which I'm excited to bring, especially next week is 420 week. So it's a good time to talk about that, I think, and the importance of growing hemp for our economy and our environment. So it's a big part of organic gardening to me and sustainability for our whole country. And to be, when I first went to Mike's website today, it just brought tears to my eyes. I know my listeners are going to love this episode. It's going to touch your hearts in ways you won't believe. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself. You're in Kentucky, right?
I am. I am now. I originally, actually, I grew up on the other end of the Appalachian Mountains. Ironically, not that much different from the little town that we live in now.
So is that like Maine?
Or that we farm
that
in now.
Mean?
Yeah, in Maine. Okay. I grew up in Maine, a small little community called the Avon Valley, Maine. And, you know, we grew up on a subsistence farm with my grandfather and all my aunts and uncles. And, you know, sadly, I spent about the better part of my life trying to get away from that. And it's really been the last seven or eight years.
I was just going to interrupt really quick and tell you, you'd be surprised how many of my guests have said that. And I think it's just important for listeners to remember, if your kids are giving you any kind of, you know, feedback or, you know, a little bit of they're not interested, they're going to appreciate it. So just keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh,
go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I'll take that ball you just gave me and run with it.
Okay.
In trying to learn a little bit more about how I fought so hard to get away from my childhood, I actually find myself back in school. Wendell Berry and the Berry Center established a program at St. Catherine's College, the Berry Farming Program. So I'm currently working on a degree in community and regional leadership with an emphasis in agrarianism under the ideas and concepts of Wendell Berry. And in doing that, we actually had to this year move off the farm. And I have to say, one of the proudest moments of my life, not moving off the farm, but we moved into a city that's closer to the school. We still have the farm and we're still farming it, but my son for about 3 weeks was just awful. And he wouldn't tell us why, and he was very upset. Didn't like it anything. And so I finally got him in a good place where he'd talk to me, and I realized that he was really mad because we weren't farmers anymore. We didn't live on a farm. And I really have to say, it was really sort of a proud moment for me because I remember how traumatic it was for me not wanting to be the son or grandson of a poor farmer. I wanted to be something. And so I felt like maybe I'd done a little something right by at least instilling in my son that being a farmer was in fact something noble. So yeah, I think there is hope.
And you've done a lot of something right. And it's going to grow, and it is growing, and it's just so important. You should be really proud of yourself.
I think that when I look at that, I hear that a bit, but I think that the important takeaway from that is I'm not, there's nothing special about me. I'm just somebody that wanted to make a difference and felt like we could do a little bit better than we were. I'm saddened personally that it took me having children to understand the value of the relationships and the environment to really be doing this work. But I just would reiterate to anybody listening, I'm or anybody else is doing the work I'm doing, it's no different than you. We just decided that we weren't going to take no for an answer, and we were going to forge a new path that was meaningful. So while I appreciate your your kind words. I don't, there's nothing special over here in this head or in this body. So, everybody grab a shovel and start growing something.
Cool. And it's all about the journey. And we all, you know, every part of our journey is, you know, with this podcast, especially because it took me so long to launch, I just think everything happens in its own time. So if this is when it hit you, don't worry about it not hitting you earlier or whatever. Like, there, those lessons that you learned on the way to where you are making what it is today. So, all right. Let's just go ahead and hit the interview script and we'll, you know, I mean, did you have anything else you wanted to add about telling us about yourself?
I mean, that's, you know, I'm just a little farmer trying to do good by the world. So, no, I think that's enough.
Okay. So tell me about your first, well, you kind of talked a little bit about your first gardening experience, but I always like to ask people, like, you know, how big, how old were you? I guess, well, you grew up on a farm and you told, did you tell us how big it was?
We had, it was good size, I'd say. I mean, it wasn't a massive farm. We lived, like I said, at the foothills of the mountains. You know, we had a couple pigs every year. We had a cow, you know, a couple cows. We had probably a half an acre garden.
Okay.
But, you know, I left there when I was, nine.
Oh.
Because apparently my mother had the same desire to escape the confines of quote unquote poverty as I did. So we left that when I was very young, and it wasn't until actually about 10 years ago that I started actually really farming. And I wish I work with a lot of veterans. I get to say this a lot. They have a lot of really cool stories about why they started farming, and they're very, they're very empowering and powerful. And mine is, I was just trying to impress the woman that would become my wife. I was passing through and I decided I'd stick around a little longer because we were hitting it off pretty well. And I had to find something to do. So we went and looked at this small organic farm in Gravel Switch, Kentucky, that was offering a summer internship. And, we did a tour, and on the way home, I said, well, what do you think about that? And she said, I think it's sexy. And I did what any guy did. I picked up the phone and said, I'll take the position. Sign me up. I've got to be there. And that's how it started. So, testament to her, I guess.
Nice. Okay. So tell us about, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
You know, we have this system that doesn't even classify the damages or the impact that we have on the earth right now. I mean, it's an externality, which, you know, literally means it doesn't factor in. So I think that, you know, we have to, as a species, understand the confines. I think that organic gardening to me is understanding the confines of the system and understanding that we live in a world where everything is connected, and we have to weigh the consequences of our choices. We have a lot of very special gifts, that we've been given, wherever you believe they came from. And so this is, I mean, for me, that's the heart of organic farming, is being conscious and aware of what we have and having respect for everything and understanding its value. So I think that it's the most important thing in the world. And I think that it doesn't happen enough. And I think that by not doing it, we're doing a great discredit to future generations. Somewhere along the way, we lost this, or we changed this sort of concept of dominion, and it became something of a master-servant relationship. But I don't think that we were put here to leave this place worse off than when we got here. So for me, organic and earth-friendly gardening means me doing my best to leave this place better than when I got here.
Oh, that's
sort of, I guess I'm paying rent.
Right. My husband says things like that a lot too. He totally believes that you know, we need to really take care of our planet and worry about our kids and our grandkids and the future. So how did you learn
stewardship?
Exactly. How did you learn how to use organic techniques? Like, was your grandfather's farm like that, or did you learn it somewhere else, or what inspired you to start growing organically?
You know, I had always, before we had children, before I met my wife, I had always been purchasing organic. I had always sort of had this connection to, you know, deep. I mean, I grew up on the land, and I guess that was the one thing that couldn't be taken away from me. So I've always been purchasing. So, you know, and of course that first internship was on an organic farm. And, you know, I guess there wasn't any one thing that happened. It just, you know, when you think about what a pesticide or something like that is, and it's, you know, it's designed to kill. I guess, why would we eat it? So, right. I mean, I don't have any profound answer for that, except it doesn't make sense to do it any other way. I mean, you know, you look at these, I can't even remember the name of it, but there's a new potato, you know, bug killer out there that you put on the roots. You apply it to the roots. Well, you know, that's the part we eat. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you put something that kills something on something that you're going to eat? So, I don't know. I mean, I don't that, and it's just the right thing to do. My heavens. I mean, we've decimated our soil over and over again. We've got a drought going on because we've been farming based solely on profits and not based on responsible stewardship. I mean, I don't know. It's just right. It's the right thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, let's talk about your garden this year, or maybe, you know, last year, or like before. Probably before your move, maybe. Tell us about something that grew well.
Well, hemp grew really well.
All right. Tell us about that. And why did that grow so well?
You know, if I was, I might jinx myself, but probably just because it was the first year. It's like anytime I grow something for the first time, it grows really well. And then when I build a strong production plan around it to increase that production and hopefully increase my margins, I missed a beat and something went wrong. But, you know, I mean, the real answer is we're in the best climate for it. I mean, Kentucky has historically produced 90% of the hemp this country ever used. Our climate and our soil is situated to it. You know, it was just amazing. It was, I mean, it really, I mean, it blew our minds. We had this, you know, I always say, you know, when I talk about this, I say, you know, you get a seed pack, right? And it says your tomatoes will take, you know, 65 days for this variety to be harvesting. And so, I mean, the seed pack on the hemp wasn't really a seed pack, but for all intents and purposes, the seed pack said 110 days. And we were, you know, we were harvesting 6 to 8 foot plants at, you know, 52 days. And it was, you know, we were caught completely off guard by how well the crop did. It was almost like a homecoming, you know, it's like, wow, I'm home. It's exciting. I'm just going to give it my all. And it just came through. And we were blessed with, based on what we've seen, one of the best looking hemp crops in the country last year.
Right.
Now,
unfortunately, there are not a lot of hemp crops in the country. Okay, so let's back up a little. Some of my listeners are probably like, what the heck is hemp? Want to tell them?
Yeah, hemp is it's a member of the cannabis sativa family. So it is related to marijuana, although it's distinctly different. Marijuana is grown for its psychoactive properties of THC, whereas industrial hemp is grown for its fiber. Here in Kentucky, and I guess in the rest of the United States, if this new legislation passes, the federal limit for THC is 0.3%. So 0.3% is the maximum amount of tetrahydrocannabidiols that can be, or THC that can be in a hemp plant for it not to be classified as marijuana. But hemp, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I always try not to talk about it because I always feel like I'm talking about it, but it's really amazing.
I just have to interrupt.
Has over 25,000 uses. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so important. Like, somebody was telling me about this interview with President Obama and the youth today, and they were talking about legalization and decriminalization, and he was saying, you know, there are more important issues like the economy and climate change that you should be worried about. And to me, hemp could solve both of those problems, both the economy and, you know, reduce climate change for so many reasons. And we are not growing hemp because of the classification of marijuana when they are two very separate things. There's no way anybody's going to smoke a hemp plant. It grows completely different. And go on and tell us about the 25,000 uses. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, you're fine. You know, you're absolutely right. And I mean, that I think that that is part of the reason that we were fortunate enough to get a pilot project last year on our farm, because we understood that, just from the context up until the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, which classified hemp as marijuana, about 70% of our paper came from hemp.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, that's just one example. We previously made paper from a waste product, you know, from clothing that had been worn out, or from a crop that, you know, grow 1 acre worth of 1 year's growth is makes as much paper as 4 acres worth of trees that took, if you read the government, it takes 15 years to grow an acre of trees. But I think Mother Nature might think it takes 50 to 60.
In Montana, it's even longer.
Yeah, I mean, I have a briefcase that's made out of hemp plastic. Last weekend in Colorado at a hemp exposition, I drove a BMW car that 80% of the plastics came from hemp, right? Plastics.
Mm-hmm.
These are
mm-hmm.
things that, mm-hmm. you know.
Henry Ford built one of his first cars out of hemp plastic.
It says it's stronger than steel. Stronger and lighter. I was part of the before we disbanded it, part of a lobbying group, and we conducted a white paper that did research with Ford, and, you know, a car, the Ford Fusion with hemp plastics in it has less weight and more fuel efficiency and a higher impact rating. So I think that there's this huge potential. And when you talked about the economic thing, you hit on that completely. One of the big negatives that we hear when we're out working and trying to generate business and income from this is that, well, it needs so much infrastructure to be built that, you know, it's not feasible. Well, you know, I live in an area where I watch them waste money on road infrastructure that totally eliminates historic downtowns and puts in minimum wage jobs for faceless corporations that have no ties to our community. So, I mean, come on, if we have to build something, let's build something. I mean, let's not build a road. Let's build some infrastructure that's going to get farmers growing. It's going to get people off this, off this dependency culture that we've created with our political and our economic system. And let's grow something. I agree 100%. The economic benefit to growing this crop is huge. And the biggest economic benefit to that is that there is no infrastructure. It all has to be built. And when communities build something, they own it. It's not McDonald's, or not to pick on any company, it's not McDonald's or any other fast food company or restaurant chain business coming in and building something that looks like something everywhere else. This is communities have an opportunity. And I'm very short-sighted on our president, I guess, for that. I didn't hear him say that.
I actually didn't hear him it either. I heard about it on a different podcast. They were talking about an interview, I have to say. But I was more upset at the interviewer for not bringing that up. But I got to go back to like a couple more uses, because to me, especially with the Organic Gardener podcast that talks about food, one of the other big things is hemp seeds are full of protein. They're the hemp seed oil. Like, I always, one of my favorite recipes is my hemp seed oil salad dressing. And that stuff costs a fortune. And it's so good for you. People are always talking about eat hemp seed protein. And I'm like, oh, yeah, hemp seed protein. That's like $16 for this fancy package that has to be, you know, the containers in the refrigerated section. Yeah. And I can't grow it in my own garden. But people are constantly telling me it's the best thing that I need to eat and put it in my green smoothie.
I just read this story about the blue zones, which are these parts of the world where there's eight of them, and they have the longest life expectancy of anybody. And the one with the, I believe the average age is 102 years old in this village. It's in the Hunan province of China, and 80% of their diet. Well, actually, it's important to say they have several things in common. All of these blue zones, they are a very agrarian culture. Mm-hmm. So they're connected to the land. They're very spiritual. Mm-hmm. Whichever way they go with that spirituality, I don't know all the different religious or spiritual beliefs. But then the other thing is they eat a superfood that is hemp seed protein. Mm-hmm. And this is the bulk of their diet. And it is a huge food source. And it produces more yields per acre than a lot of other grain crops. Mm-hmm. And then it carries over to textiles, which has been a big part of our project. I mean, we've been working with Fibershed and Patagonia on these textiles.
Because,
you know, with the nylon, although, not necessarily bad in existence, the process for which they make it is extremely polluting. And then it also makes it so that we can't recycle, because we haven't found an efficient way to recycle nylon that we're putting into clothing. So when nylon clothing goes bad, it goes to a landfill. When hemp or cotton clothing goes bad, it gets recycled and put into paper or books or, any number of uses, plastics, biofuels, but we don't have that luxury. It's really been exciting for us because there are so many options. And when you can bring options to people in communities, exciting things happen. And we've seen it. I mean, we're doing work in eastern Kentucky in small rural farm communities. And we're seeing the excitement and we're seeing the local innovation pop up. We're seeing local people manufacturing equipment that we can use to process these crops. But they're using existing infrastructure. So, it's really exciting. I mean, it's same respect, it's frustrating for me too, because, you know, I spent the better part of 10 years going around trying to get people to eat local tomatoes, and then you show up with this plant that's been illegal forever and people start to make connections. But, we'll take it. I think that's the bottom line. And there's also a huge incentive right now for us to use this to transform other farmers into organic production because of the difference in the value from this crop where it's so new. There's not as much value in versus organic versus conventional in tomatoes or corn, but right now in hemp, where it's such a small market, it's huge. The value difference is huge. So this is going to help us incentivize other farmers that traditionally wouldn't go to organic over to organic. And it's a great
Excellent.
Opportunity.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. I hadn't thought about it that way. And I like the way that you're working with other farmers and within your community. I mean, you really have some talents there to reaching out to people and getting them to work together. So
it's the Wendell Berry agrarian in me.
Okay, cool. I'm gonna have to look him up.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know who he is.
He's the forefather of all of this.
Okay.
He wrote a book in 1975. A year after I was born, called The Unsettling of America, and he basically foretold everything that's happened with agriculture since then, as pretty much happened, and he foresaw it in his book.
Okay.
And he's been a writer and a poet and a farmer, and that's, he's world renowned for that. Actually his poem, The Contrariness of the Mad Farmer, is sort of my mantra. That's sort of my motto, my creed to live by. So if you have a chance to look that up, that's what I would look up, The Contrariness of the Mad Farmer.
Okay, you got it. All right, well, how about something you want to do different next year, or something you're going to try new?
Oh man, we're always trying new things. It's ironic. I just gave a talk somewhere about this, and when I started this, I thought I was going to be a farmer. I had no idea I was going to be a farmer, an entrepreneur, an innovator, an inventor, a marketer, a social media campaigner, a blogger, and that's. So, this sort of new face of what it takes to be a successful farmer in this economy is it seems like we're always doing something new. But specifically, I mean, we're transitioning and starting to use the hemp crop as some feedstock for our livestock on the farm. Given the plant's drought resistance, disease resistance, and its ability to thrive in almost any climate, we're excited to see how our chickens and our hogs respond to a diet of organic hemp seeds, high protein hemp seeds. So that's probably our biggest endeavor for the new year. That, and we're doing a lot more hand processing of the hemp fibers for artisan spinners. So those are our two biggest new adventures this year.
Excellent. I lost my train of thought. I was going to say something else about the protein. All right, I'll think about it in a second. How about something that didn't work so well this season?
We how do I put this eloquently? We were trying to work with a lot more farmers than we did, and the communication, I think, was a big issue. It's a hard thing to get strong-minded, independent people working together. So we're constantly retooling our approach and retooling our methods to create support networks, both for production and knowledge. I feel like we could have done a lot better on that. We also could have done a lot better on our sweet potatoes, but we lost a lot of time on a lot of things. This hemp crop took a lot more than we thought it was going to take for manpower, not work on the farm, but just responding to media requests and interviews, and it took a lot of time. So a lot of our vegetable production suffered a little bit for that.
Okay, that's a good answer. And it shows that people are interested, which I'd like to hear because, I mean, I first started working on promoting hemp back in 1993 when we first got married. So, to me, it's taken forever. And I remember my parents being like, "What? Are you crazy?" And now, you can't go into a store without seeing, shampoo with hemp seed. Every Christmas, Walmart, I'm sitting there and here's this hemp jewelry making kit for, teenagers and just, it's like in some ways it's everywhere except for you can't buy the seeds in the United States. You can't hardly grow the seeds here. There's so many, it's just insane. We pay these outrageous prices to import it from everywhere. So I'm glad to hear that
Well,
you're busy with the media because we do need it and you're educated about it.
one thing that I always feel like I'm the great dream smasher here. But I always try to tell people this isn't, because what I see is I get emails every day from people. Hey, you know what? We decided to buy a farm and grow hemp. And I just think we didn't just decide overnight to be a farmer. It's not. So there's a lot of misconceptions because what happened is we were painting this picture moving forward and trying to get the right to grow this crop of the best case scenario, and the opposition was painting the worst case scenario. And now that we're here and we're growing it, we have to start bringing back expectations into the middle. This isn't something that I mean, I would say that, and my wife and everybody that I work with would echo that. This is not something you should dive into without fully understanding the struggles. I mean, this hasn't been easy, and we probably aren't going to make any money off this crop for 3 to 4 years because there's so much research and development. There's so much work to be done. There, the processing equipment's not there. You think we could just grow this and Patagonia could turn and make clothing with it. No, I mean, it has to be cottonized. The entire industry is built for one specific type of crop, and while they use and so. There's a lot of nuances that people don't understand. So I often feel like I'm the guy that's saying, hey, whoa, hold on. You're not gonna make money this year, and you're certainly not gonna make that much money this year off it. You're still farming. This isn't a green rush like what everybody seems to be putting out there. There's a lot of potential, and there's an amazing future for this, but it's for the next 3 to 5 years, this is gonna be a lot of hard work and a lot of headaches and a lot of failures and a lot of learning.
Okay, I thought about what I was going to say before. Now, also, is there not a risk? Is it now? I know Obama did sign the hemp growing, that you can grow hemp act last year, but can the DEA still come in and take your crop, or can they not do that anymore?
Well, of course. I mean, it depends on who you ask, but I wouldn't be surprised if they could, to find out that they could. We're getting ready to have an election coming up here.
Right, there you go.
The president changes office and decides that we're not within the confines, and, we're just like those other states growing marijuana under the 10th Amendment, I guess, in that regard, mm-hmm. without federal authorization.
Because I know they had done that.
A state.
Before, like in Colorado, there were, I think, even some Native Americans that had grown a crop, and then the DEA came in right at the end, right at the end of the season, and just took it all. And
yeah, that was.
They have done that.
Yeah, Alex Whiteplume, uh-huh. from the Lakota Pine Ridge Reservation in the Dakotas, they did that too. We're lucky in Kentucky. Our legislators, right. Our Ag Commissioner Comer, they did a great job. I mean, we're not operating under the 10th Amendment. Last year, we had the first federally permitted industrial hemp crop. We're not growing this crop under the 10th Amendment, which is what all of the other states are currently doing. We have that in our favor. But, yeah, at the end of the day, look, these guys, we don't vote for these guys. They have their own agenda. If they want to come take our crops, I'm pretty sure they can come take our crops.
So.
I'm not delusional about that. We just hope that we're doing everything with our testing and within the confines of that system, trying to say, look, we're not trying to grow marijuana. We don't have any interest in it. As far as I'm concerned, there is no economic benefit to a farmer to growing marijuana. If they legalize it, it's not going to be me growing marijuana. It's going to be rich bankers that have these big facilities, like what's going on in Colorado and California.
Right.
We don't have any interest in that. We've been pretty vocal about that. Personally, I don't care. It's a free choice. You should be able to do what you want. But in the same regards, if they did blanketly legalize marijuana across the country, you can only imagine the regulatory framework that would be behind it. And it just wouldn't make it back to the farm gate. I don't see how it could make it back to the farm gate. And that's our interest, is in farm gate income, not anything else. So we just don't have a dog in that fight. So we hope that by making that distinction, having our tests done, we over-test our crops. We're sending them out weekly for samples of the leaf and the plant matter to make sure we're, within the confines of the legal limit, and we share those, and we just try to keep moving forward as transparent and honest as we can.
But there's definitely, to me, it just seems absurd. Hemp that you're growing for the fibers is this tall stalk, right? And they grow very close together with very few leaves.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a totally different growing process. Like, I went up to our senator tester at this business fair he had and asked him a question about it. And he was like, I did try to get a hemp bill passed, but the thing that held us back was they decided that the police couldn't tell the difference between a cannabis plant and a hemp plant. And to me, that was just total political irrationalization, because when you look at the pictures of what a pot plant looks like and what a hemp plant looks like, it's just so different the way they're grown, and you're growing it for that tall fiber. That's where, I guess if you're growing it for the seeds and the protein, it might be different. I don't know what those plants look like, but the fiber to make the fabric out of, and the cars and things like that, I think, is just grown in a completely different way, and that you have to do all this testing that probably cost you money too. Seems kind of wasteful, where that money could be going maybe towards your production or something. But anyway, sorry, there's my little two bits. How about something you find that is easy to grow and generally successful every time in your area? And maybe you're going to say that's hemp because you are in Kentucky.
We've only got 1 year under our belt. I really like sorghum, grain sorghum. Does really well for us.
What do you do with that? Is that for feeding your animals?
We feed it. Yeah, we feed it to the animals. Of course, tobacco, although we haven't grown that for a number of years. But we always have a pretty consistent tomato crop.
Okay. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Oh, man. Collard greens.
Yep.
That just invites the pests.
Really? Okay.
Seems to invite the cabbage borers more than anything else on our farm, so we tend to stay away from it. Maybe they just have a taste for it here.
Okay.
They snuck up from Georgia.
Huh. Which activity is your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something that you got to force yourself to get out there and do?
I can't really say that I do. I mean, I try to adopt this principle that everything has a purpose and a place, so everything deserves just as much attention and just as much care. I don't know that there is anything I don't enjoy less than anything else.
How about
and if there is, I try to convince myself that I don't. So
nice. I remember Martha Stewart once talked about polishing her silver, and she was like, I don't look at it as a chore. I look at it as something I have silver to polish, and I get to do this every day. And I try to take that attitude into my chores. It doesn't always work, but I do give it my best. How about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
I like to hoe a row. I like to get out there with my scuffle hoe and hoe a row. I guess that's counterintuitive to what I just said, but that's one of my meditative jobs.
Mm-hmm. What is the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Oh my gosh! Wow, I wasn't ready for that one.
How about your quote from the instructions for the cook, the nurturing mind that you were telling me about in the pre-interview?
It comes from Dojin, his advice for cooks, and it's the quote is, this attitude is called the nurturing mind. Instead of putting ourselves first on every occasion, we aim to cultivate a true heart towards people and things and put ourselves in other places at every encounter. So I think, that for me ties back to the stewardship concept. We have to be keenly aware of everything and how it fits in. Plucking a weed is not as simple as plucking a weed, but weed may have served a purpose that we weren't aware of. So, being aware of everything and its place is one of the biggest things that I've been advised of over the last few years.
Okay. How about your favorite tool? You were saying your scuffle hole. Is that if you had to move and could only take one tool, is that what it would be?
It would be my scuffle hole. Yes.
And what is a scuffle hole exactly? Like, is it different than a regular hole, or like you want to describe it a little?
Yeah, it's got a triangle blade that sits flat on the ground, and all three points are sharpened. So you hold it at sort of a 45-degree angle and just slide it across the ground, and it cuts out the weeds, the heads of the weeds.
Okay. How about any tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? That's probably my biggest challenge. I always go down and pick this huge basket of lettuce and bring it up, and then I'm lucky if I wash it that day and eat it the next day. Or, food always comes on in big bunches to me, it seems like. Got any tips for that?
Timing, succession planting made a big difference for us.
Okay.
When we started expanding on a CSA, instead of putting out 500 broccoli plants, we would we'd stagger that. It comes down to more planning, but if you put 10 plants in and every 5 days, you sort of staggered off your your harvest. So it would really come down to planting.
Nice. How about secrets for preserving food or making it last at all? Do you do any canning or freezing or any of that kind of thing?
My secret was I found a good wife and knew how to do it.
There you go.
I'm not the preserver.
Okay. How about special techniques for cooking any weird or unusual foods? Anything you grow down there that's different that people might want to learn about?
I mean, it's so hard to tell these days. I don't know what is weird or unusual anymore. It seems like 5 years ago, there's all kinds of weird and unusual things. But, you know, it seems like everybody knows what bok choy and radicchio is now. Go ahead and tell our listener,
if you have something else.
Yeah, I would say one thing that amazed me that I actually tried a few years ago when I got here, I was delivering some of my nicest organic salad mix. Mm-hmm. And we were delivering for a CSA, and part of that we donated a couple shares to a local church so that they could have, if there were people that didn't have any money or were hungry, they could come and get a basket of food. One of those customers mm-hmm. that first year came to get a basket of food, and they picked up that lettuce mix, and they said, "Oh, great. What do you like?" I started listing off the greens in the salad mix, and they go, "Oh, no, I didn't know about all that. I'm just going to put this in my skillet and pour some hot bacon grease on it and wilt it down." And, me being a Yankee, I'd never seen that. And I thought, well, that's sacrilege. I went home and started talking to some family, and I actually tried it for myself and realized that, they're onto something.
Okay.
So, wilted greens and bacon grease is maybe not great for you, but tasty.
Okay. I can see where you're coming from. Like, this new green smoothie movement's kind of got me, because I like practically was in tears the first time I put spinach in my blender and was just like, what? I was like, I finally splurged and bought some spinach in the winter and I'm going to put this in the blender. Like, I don't know who that green smoothie thing's for. If it's for people who don't like vegetables, I don't think it's for me, but I don't know. I gave it a try for a while. But go ahead and just quickly tell the listeners, what is bok choy and what is radicchio? Because some of them might not know.
Bok choy is about the prettiest thing you'll ever grow. It looks like a little vase in your field. It's a Chinese cabbage. We use it a lot just in stir fries, chop it up in stir fries. We also use it in salads. So that's our main use for the bok choy, and that's what we recommend for our CSA customers. Radicchio is sort of a bitter, bright red. If you ever buy the custom mixed salads, the radicchio is that beautiful sort of harder white red-ish bitter lettuce, which is I love that. A little bit of balsamic vinegar on some radicchio with garlic, and I'm a happy camper.
Cool. Okay. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? Is that it or something
else?
Oh,
boy. That would be it. I mean, I wouldn't even cook it. I would just mm-hmm. I would just cut it and toss in some garlic and on that radicchio. And actually, I will say I probably would mix in bok choy too and make a little fresh garlic salad. With some radicchio and bok choy is probably my favorite. Yeah.
Cool. How about a favorite internet resource?
Oh, Atra.
Atra. Is that that? Tell us what Atra is. I think one of my guests at the beginning told me about that.
It's a division of the National Center for Appropriate Technologies. It was started in the 70s. The acronym stands for Appropriate Technologies Transferred to Rural America. Their online educational resource database is hands down the best that I've seen. They have field representatives across the country. Their understanding of sustainable agriculture is top notch. So on top of an internet resource, they also, they have people you can call.
Cool. Okay. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog or anything?
Yeah. The Unsettling of America by Wendell Berry.
Okay, cool.
I think it's still a valid and important read for everybody, and I probably find myself in it twice a week.
Okay, cool. Okay, so how about business advice? Got any business advice on how to sell extra produce or get started in the industry, either the hemp one or starting a CSA or...
You know, for me, it's been all about relationships, cultivating relationships with people, and making sure that they understand what sets me apart. Why am I different? Why is it important that they bought salad or eggs from me versus the grocery store? You know, so find a way to set yourself apart. It's there. Even if you don't know it, there's something special about you that is going to help you make connections with people and help people see the value that they bring to them. So.
Excellent. I think that's so important. And I've just listened to a podcast. My friend Katie Kremitzos has the Businesswoman Rock, where she interviews professional people. And she had a woman on who talked about the basics of marketing, which on a gardening podcast might not seem important. But, you know, if you're going to try to, you know, produce a product and sell it, marketing is just essential. And they talked about, you know, stick to the basics, you know, who you are. Why somebody, what makes you stand out? And that was like the number two most important thing. And then how to get a hold of you, I think was number three. But, you know, why somebody should, you know, buy from you or what makes your product different. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? Like, is there a charity or an organization you're passionate about? A project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either in your local area or on a national or global scale?
Food security is obviously the biggest issue we have. I'm fortunate to be a part of a nonprofit, Growing Warriors, that does some amazing work with veterans, but it's very food security oriented, teaching people to grow and care for themselves and be able to nurture their own bodies is a really empowering thing. And it replaces a sense of dignity for people. So I think that food security is number one.
You know, can we talk about that just for a little minute or two more? Because we didn't really get into that. And that's how I found you to begin with, was through the Growing Warriors. Like, tell the listener, we haven't even told them what that is, have we?
No. Growing Warriors is a nonprofit that I started in 2012. I was doing economic development work around agriculture in the eastern part of Kentucky in the Appalachian Mountains, and I was preparing a talk for some councilmen and economic developers, and I came across a statistic that over a million military veterans are on food stamps, and I being a veteran and coming from a family of veterans, I took that kind of personally. The protectors and all the freedoms and the rights that we have are now in a line with their handout. And so we started that first year with a community garden. We trained 10 families to grow their own food, and they then some of those people have gone on and started their own food security projects in other communities. We have a number of sites across Kentucky and some other states that they're all distinctly different. So what started as sort of a food security project, we like to think has turned into sort of an empowerment project for veterans, really allowing them to take charge of food security in their community as it needs to be addressed from their perspective. We're excited. This Friday, we're with members and support from the greater community in Louisville, Kentucky, we'll be building some raised garden beds at a homeless shelter and teaching homeless veterans how to grow, preserve, and create food products. We're really just about teaching people to grow food and grow community through that process.
Mm-hmm. How about also, there was a statistic on that video that just kind of brought me to tears. And I hear about this a lot because we watch like Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Tom Hartman, where they talk about veterans a lot. And the staggering suicide rate. Like, did it say, is it 22 veterans commit suicide every day? Like that just...
Yeah, and you know, that's, well, and that's not an accurate number, too. That's the really disturbing thing.
Right.
That number is derived from the Department of Veteran Affairs, the Department of, and that's because they issue the headstones. So now if you look at the, so that the 22 veterans a day that are committing suicide are the veterans that are receiving help. Our government estimates that roughly 35 to 40% of veterans aren't even in the system. So the number of suicides that we're reporting on are only the veterans that we're giving assistance to. So yeah, I mean it's a national tragedy, and I, you know, there's a direct correlation for me. There's these two groups that when you say their names in America, we start waving the flags and stomping up and down, and they're farmers and veterans. But when we go to the checkout aisle and when it's time to put our money where our mouth is, we're not willing to do that. So I kind of find my, you know, I find the irony in that, that these are both the two groups of people that we love and can't live without, but when it comes time to truly supporting them, we don't know how to act upon that.
So you're doing such important work by connecting both of those groups and empowering people. To me, that, you know, that's such a key thing to talk about, how growing food empowers people to be self-sufficient. And, you know, Tom Hartman was just reading some statistics yesterday about the states in the United States who have the biggest, strongest welfare systems actually have the lowest rates of unemployment and the more people actually going to work, and that by supporting those systems, they actually have less people needing assistance in the long run, that those systems are really paying off. So, you know, people that say, you know, people who are on welfare just want a hand. I mean, you know, living in Montana, I've worked side by side with the working poor for 20 years now. You know, nobody wants a handout if they don't need one. Nobody wants to be on food stamps if they don't need to. But finding, you know, jobs that will pay. And this is why I'm so passionate about hemp, I think, because it can boost our economy and create good paying jobs that are healthy, that are sustainable. You know, you don't need the chemicals to grow hemp that you need to grow cotton. Right. And I just I'm very passionate about it because I think because I've worked so hard by people who are struggling and hard workers. And I can't, like, when I worked at Head Start for 2 years full time, my mom was just like, how can you not have health insurance? And I was like, because it would, they don't have it in the budget. Just because it's Head Start doesn't mean I'm a full time employee, doesn't mean I'm entitled to health insurance. And just, she didn't understand that for a long time. How many people I've worked side by side that can't go to the doctor because, you know, and they're working full time. And I just so glad to see that you're doing things about this. Anyway, have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden.
I like quotes. How about another Dogen quote?
Sure.
An oven does not discriminate between fancy firewood and thorns. It accepts everything without preference and transforms it into thermal energy to cook rice or heat bath water.
Nice. I like that.
Can you make that? I do. Yeah, I always do, because it kind of speaks to that. You know, you make the best of what you have. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing your job right, it's always enough. So I think that's why I've always been drawn to Dogen in that regard. It sort of talks about how we have everything we need.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, taking time out away from school and your paper and your hard work to share with us all your knowledge. And just, to me, what you're doing is so important. And I think you just have some great, you know, skills for bringing people together, which is so important to that communication piece that you were talking about and building relationships. So thanks again.
Oh yeah. Hey, thanks everybody for listening. Go support a local farmer, get to know him, and save the world.
Aww. Okay. And how about a way to connect with you?
Via email or, my email is mlewis@growingwarriors.org, and I am on Twitter at growingwarriors.
Yeah.
It's my Twitter handle. I guess that's what it's called.
And the website's growingwarriors.org?
Web.org. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And I'll put the links to all of that in the show notes. And please go watch the video. Like I said, it'll bring tears to your eyes. And there's just great connections there. So thank you again, Mike, for being my guest.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you'd head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get found by other listeners and share the knowledge. Thank you again for listening. Have a great day.